Good morning. Welcome to the press briefing of the UN Information Service here in Geneva. Today is Friday, 6th of February. I know many of you are covering the conference on disarmament, which is taking place this morning. But we have a very interesting briefing today, and a neat one with Tamin, who was here for OHCHR to tell us about the situation in the occupied West Bank. You have the floor. Thank you.
Thank you, Alessandra. Good morning, everyone. A series of new Israeli operations and settlement plans in the occupied West Bank, including East Jerusalem, risks seriously undermining the viability of a Palestinian state and the realization of the Palestinians' right to self-determination. On the 12th of January, Israeli security forces launched a campaign in occupied East Jerusalem, including at least two major operations targeting two Palestinian communities. In the Shafat refugee camp, they raided dozens of homes and shops, detained at least 25 Palestinians, confiscated goods, and seized 10 private vehicles. In another large-scale operation targeting Kafr Aqab neighborhood and the boundaries of Qalandia refugee camp, Israeli security forces reportedly demolished 70 Palestinian structures. This appears to be in preparation for major settlement projects in the area. Since the 23rd of January, the Israeli authorities issued eviction orders to 22 Palestinian homes in the Muslim quarter of Jerusalem's Old City and in Al-Bustan and Batn al-Hawa areas of Silwan. This follows a series of similar notices over the past 2 months affecting hundreds of Palestinians who remain at risk of forced displacement in the larger area of Silwan. The unlawful deportation or transfer of a population living under occupation is a war crime, and under specific circumstances may constitute a crime against humanity. Relentless violence by Israeli settlers with the support and participation of Israeli security forces, as well as movement restrictions, are accelerating the forcible transfer of Palestinians. Meanwhile, the killing of Palestinians continues with generalized impunity. For example, on the 10th of January, Israeli security forces shot and killed a 58-year-old man in Hebron City while he was driving his daughter and her four children. The Israeli authorities initially claimed the man had accelerated to ram soldiers, but later said there was no evidence of that. The shooting raises concern of unlawful killing. Accountability and justice must be achieved for all the victims of unlawful killings and other human rights violations. States must act immediately to stop the aggressive Israeli expansion of illegal settlements in the occupied West Bank, including East Jerusalem. Further expansion of settlements will only entrench the racial segregation against the Palestinian people. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thanks a lot. Let me see if there are questions. I'll start with Robin.
Thank you. Tamin, are there any courses of redress which are open to Palestinians who have been given these eviction notices? What are their options in these circumstances?
Thank you for that. In fact, there can be and there should be ways of, challenging these decisions in court. In some cases, I have seen, we have received information that the Israeli authorities have given some of these people, especially when we're talking about the owners of 11 houses in the Silwan area. They have been given 20 days to evacuate their houses. This is a very short period, of course, in order to, you know, challenge the decisions at court. And we have seen that more often than not, their challenges when they go to court, they are not, they do not lead to protecting their rights to have their homes.
Thank you very much, Mohammed.
Tamin, thank you so much for the briefing. Do you have any data that shows how many people died or displaced in West Bank since the beginning of this year?
We have some information about forcible displacement in the West Bank. Since this year, I do not have specific figures since the beginning of the year, but as you may recall, it has been almost a year since the Israeli militarized campaign known as the Iron Wall started in three refugee camps in the occupied West Bank. So the camps of Jenin, Tul Karim, and Nur Shams. 32,000 Palestinians have been displaced in that context, and most of them have not been able to go back to their homes. And in fact, for many of them, their homes have been destroyed by the Israeli authorities. So we're talking about at least 32,000 people who are displaced, but of course, when we add the people who are displaced from other areas, the figures are certainly higher.
Merci beaucoup. J'ai une question concernant les familles palestiniennes chassées de leur maison, de leur foyer. Quel est le sort de ces familles? Ils vont où? Il se passe quoi avec eux? Et j'ai une autre question concernant le Liban. Je ne sais pas si tu la poses maintenant ou bien après. D'accord. Alors, il y a des informations donc confirmées par l'UNIFEL au sud du Liban qu'Israël a utilisé des substances toxiques comme le glyphosate au sud du Liban en large mesure. Est-ce que vous avez des informations? Quelles sont ces substances et quelle est votre position là-dessus? Merci beaucoup.
Merci beaucoup, Moussa. Concernant la première question, évidemment, comme vous pouvez l'imaginer, ces familles n'ont généralement nulle part où aller. On peut imaginer, je n'ai pas d'informations précises sur le sort de ces familles, où elles vont exactement, mais on peut imaginer que si certaines familles ont des proches quelque part, ils peuvent se réfugier chez leurs proches. Évidemment, on peut imaginer que d'autres personnes se mettent à l'abri dans des tentes ou des structures très basiques, évidemment, en attendant le retour dans leur maison. Pour les familles qui ont été forcées à quitter leur maison dans les trois camps, par exemple, l'année dernière, eh bien, elles attendent toujours. Et c'est pour ça que c'est très inquiétant comme situation au niveau des droits humains pour ces familles-là. Concernant la question de... Pardon ? Ah, ok. Concernant la situation au Liban et la question sur les substances chimiques, on est inquiet par ces rapports qui parlent de l'usage par des avions israéliens de substances chimiques sur des terres agricoles dans le sud du Liban et dans certaines parties de la Syrie. Si ces rapports sont confirmés, ces actes sont inquiétants par rapport au droit international humanitaire et cela requiert beaucoup plus d'investigations encore pour mettre la lumière sur la nature de ces substances chimiques. Les attaques sur les terres agricoles et sur les sources d'alimentation posent un risque sérieux, un risque humanitaire sérieux, et aussi pour l'environnement et la vie des civils dans ces endroits-là.
Moussa, maybe I could just add, yesterday the spokesperson of the Secretary General answered, I mean, made a comment on this matter, which I'm going to read here. He said, we are aware, so that's yesterday evening, we are aware of reports that the substance dropped over areas near the blue line on 1st February is an herbicide. The use of herbicides raises questions about the effects on local agricultural lands and how this might impact the return of civilians to their homes and livelihoods in the long term, as also Tamina said. We remind the parties of their obligations under international humanitarian law and other possible legal frameworks. Any activity by the IDF north of the Blue Line is a violation of Resolution 1701. UNIFIL will continue to be in contact with the Lebanese authorities on this matter. Thank you. Christiane.
Thank you. Tamin, we just talked about that before. These press releases that you put out are repeating themselves all the time. What else can your office do other than pointing out that these are violations? As there is no consequence or has been no consequence in the past to putting out those statements, is your office thinking about other avenues to achieve the result that you are aiming for? Thank you.
Thank you so much, Christiane, for that question. I mean, as you pointed out, it is really, really frustrating when we keep having to say and repeat the same messages all over again, but it's because the situation is not only repeating itself; it is worsening, in fact, for the Palestinians living in the West Bank and including East Jerusalem. What our office can do, we are continuing to document the violations that happen as far as we can with the resources that we have, and we continue to report on these violations to the Human Rights Council, to the Security Council, to the General Assembly, to the media, as I am doing here, and it is really for states, for the international community, to act immediately to stop this aggressive Israeli expansion of illegal settlements and all the violations. The international community should take its responsibility, indeed. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I had seen their hands. Robin, otherwise I'll go to the platform. There are more questions.
Thank you. On the subject of evictions, What is your office's position on the E1 expansion development to the east of Jerusalem?
Thank you for that question. It's very worrying, and we have been very clear that all settlements, all Israeli settlements in the occupied West Bank, including East Jerusalem, are illegal, and they must this activity must end, and the settlement must be evacuated because the occupation must end. That's the bottom line. So the E1 project is also very concerning because it risks separating Palestinian communities from each other, and thus affecting seriously the viability of the Palestinian state. So this one is really concerning, but the bottom line is that all settlements must be evacuated, and the settlement activity must stop. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'll go to the platform. Imogen?
Hi, good morning. Related to the West Bank, do you know anything about these supposedly private executive jets hired by ICE to deport Palestinians from America? And apparently they're just being dumped at a checkpoint close to the West Bank.
Thank you, Imogen. I am not aware of these reports, but we can check and revert back to you if we have more information. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any other question to Tamin? Let me see if there's anything on the Nick. Go ahead, Nick.
Yeah, thank you. It's on a slightly different subject, notably Iran. I'm just wondering if you have reached a conclusion on the casualty count from the latest protests and what kind of judicial action has been taken against protesters since. Thank you.
Thank you, Nick. As you can imagine, it is still very difficult to verify the number of casualties with respect to the protests in Iran. The authorities recently released a list of more than 2,900 names. Other sources suggest that the total number is much higher. So the full verification process remains very difficult because of many factors, including the problem with the shutdown on communications and the internet. There must be independent, impartial, and transparent investigations into all the allegations of killings and serious human rights violations. And of course, those who are arbitrarily detained must be released immediately and unconditionally. So this is something that we have been calling for and we keep calling for. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Other questions on this or other subject to Tamin? No? I don't see any also on the platform. Thank you very much, Tamin, for all these briefings. Giovanna. Joanna, you have a couple of announcements for UNECE this morning.
Yes, exactly.
Thank you.
Good morning, colleagues, and thank you for your attention. The United Nations has announced a draft global regulation on automated driving systems, which will allow deployment of autonomous vehicles with no supervision by a driver on public roads. This development, regulatory development, comes after 10 years of technological maturation and regulatory developments, as well as 2 years of intensive consultations and drafting. The proposal, which was adopted by the UNECE Working Party on Automated Vehicles at its last meeting in January this year, establishes uniform safety provisions and a harmonized methodology for validating vehicles with automated driving systems. This is also anchored in a safety case approach and robust research and development processes. The adoption of this draft UN regulation demonstrates the global relevance of UN-led regulatory platforms. Harmonized vehicle rules developed at UNECE are essential to avoid fragmentation at national level and also maximize economies of scale and to support safety, market access, and innovation in the automotive industry. By working globally, UNECE provides clarity to the industry and confidence to consumers. Going forward, the UNECE Working Party on Automated Vehicles will continue elaborating regulations on automated driving functionalities. We will publish full press release on this regulatory development after this press briefing and will share with you by email. I don't know if you have any questions on this before I move to my announcement.
I don't see. Yeah, Robin?
Thank you. Yeah, could you just clarify, so has the draft been adopted or is that going to be something that happens later? And once, like, when will this process be finalized and how many countries will it apply to?
Yes. Yes, thank you for that question. The formal adoption is expected at the end of June this year at the World Forum for Harmonization of Vehicle Regulations. And then immediately afterwards, it would enter into force. As to how many countries would implement the global regulations, it really depends on how they proceed at the national level with the transposition in their laws and regulations. But just to give you an idea that there is a widespread interest by countries in adopting such a regulation, I'll mention that the regulatory activities on this issue were led by United States, Canada, UK, China, Japan, and European Union. So as you can see, there's quite a wide coalition behind this regulatory effort.
Emma, is this a question on the regulation?
Yes, it is.
Sorry, I didn't. Go ahead.
Yes. I was just wondering, why are you telling us now when it happened in January? It's just, it's a really interesting topic, but could you not have told us then? And a little bit more background, please. Can you tell us how long it took to get here and the challenges you had along the way? Thank you.
Okay, forgetting this. Yeah, thank you for your questions. So just to answer your second question, as I mentioned, this comes after 10 years of work on the issue and 2 years of intensive consultations and drafting within the working party itself. As for your question of why it was not adopted earlier in January, well, this is quite a complex task. So there were many, many aspects of this regulatory work. And let me just mention that the working party is still finalizing technical provisions regarding data collection for automated driving systems. So there are quite many pieces of this regulation, and the answer is simply it took that long because of the complexity of the issue. I hope this answers your questions.
Yeah, I don't see Emma's hands up. So maybe you want to go to your second item?
Yes, thank you. Yes, so I also wanted to draw your attention to the 88th session of the UNICE Inland Transport Committee, which will take place here at Palais des Nations from 17th to 20th of February. UNICE's Inland Transport Committee is the main UN regulatory body for road inland transport. It has a role which is equivalent to that of the International Civil Aviation Organization for Air Transport and to International Maritime Organization for Sea Transport. The committee brings together all United Nations member states and oversees more than 60 international legal instruments that cover vehicle regulations, transport on dangerous goods, border facilitation, infrastructure networks, and multimodal transport. The focus of this year's session will be on driving innovation for the future of inland transport. This means focusing on accelerating the responsible adoption of innovative technologies in inland transport and promoting efficiency and interoperability across borders and sectors. Over 4 days of the event, more than 20 ministers from all regions of the world, alongside senior government officials and heads of international organizations, as well as leaders from industry and civil society, will discuss strategic priorities and consider a wide range of policies and governance and technical issues in the sector. The central part of the discussion will take place on Wednesday, 18th of February. There will be 3 ministerial panels focused on innovation and automation in inland transport, connectivity, mobility, and trade, as well as infrastructure, data, and digitalization. Let me also draw your attention to a live demonstration that will be held also on Wednesday, 18th of February, during lunchtime. This live demonstration will showcase how next-generation intelligent transport systems can protect cyclists and improve the safety of vulnerable road users. The demonstration will take place just next to the Assembly Hall, where this main high-level segment of the event will take place. And it will feature out-of-sight detection, which allows vehicles to receive warnings and predictive data from external sources through connected devices. So I hope that if you're interested, you can attend this demonstration. Also, just to wrap up this announcement, let me just say that in a testament of the practical value of multilateral treaties that are under the purview of Inland Transport Committee, Brazil has just acceded to the TIR Convention. This is the convention that governs the global customs transit system for road and multimodal transport of goods. Brazil's accession marks a fundamental step for the customs and regional trade integration in South America, and the TIR Convention will enter into force for Brazil on 30th of July this year. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Giovanna. Any further question, Robin?
Thank you. Yeah, just on that subject of Brazil joining the convention, what could that mean for the transport of goods from the Pacific to the Atlantic, from the Atlantic to the Pacific?
Yes. So we have published this press release yesterday, and let me just give you some of the figures that also comes from OECD's research. So the adoption or accession by Brazil to TIR connection will help movement of goods across the bioceanic corridor. So this is a corridor that connects the Pacific and Atlantic Oceans from the ports in Chile, going through Paraguay and Argentina, to the port of Santos in Brazil, near Sao Paulo. And let me just stress that Santos is Latin America's busiest port and handles almost 30% of Brazil's foreign trade, which is valued at $629 billion. So it is estimated that this corridor could move more than 8.6 million tons of products annually. And once the TIR Convention is adopted, implemented by Brazil, this adoption can reduce the cross-border transport times for goods by up to 92% and costs by up to 50%. So I think these figures give you an idea of the importance of the TIR adoption or accession by Brazil.
Anyone else? Thank you very much, Giovanna, for this information. I just have a few more announcements for you. First of all, we have online Charlotte Sector from UNAIDS. They have, you've probably seen the press release that they published yesterday welcoming the new US funding package for HIV. So if you have any question, Charlotte is online to answer. Also online to answer, Marcelo Risi, who can answer questions related to the press conference that ANCTAD is going to give on the 10th of February at 9:30, just before the briefing. The subject of the press conference is the publication of the Least Developed Countries Report 2026, whose title is Our Services, the New Path to Structural Transformation. This is under embargo, including the press conference. And Rebecca Greenspan, the UN Trade and Development Secretary General, will be there to brief you, together with the Directorate Interim for Asia, for Africa, LDCs and Special Program, and an Economic Affairs Officer. So if you have questions for Marcelo, he's also online. The Secretary General is in Milan at the moment, where he is going to attend the opening ceremony of the Winter Olympics, and will also meet with the new president of the International Olympic Committee. There will be a video message from the Secretary General, which will be played during the opening ceremony. In that message, he is expected to underscore that the Olympics and the Paralympics are beacon of hope, as well as celebration of human potential, teamwork, fair play, and mutual respect. And I hope you'll follow the opening ceremony. You will hear the words of the Secretary General. On the issue of human rights, I've been asked by the colleague at the Council to read you this announcement. The Human Rights Council will hold an organizational meeting on its upcoming 61st session on Monday morning, 9th of February. Council members will adopt the program of work and hear from states on their initiatives for this session. The same day, after the organizational meeting, the Human Rights Council will hear an oral update by the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Volker Türk, on the situation in and around El Fasher in Sudan. This oral update is requested by a resolution of the Council adopted at its 38th special session on Sudan last November. And of course, Pascal and his team are available to answer your question on this. Also on human rights, the Committee on the Elimination of Discrimination Against Women is reviewing today the report of the Netherlands. Following will be Argentina, Czech Republic, El Salvador, and Lesotho. The Committee on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights will open next Monday at 12:30 its 79th session, which will last until the 25th of February. They will be reviewing the reports of Kenya, Uruguay, Georgia, and Australia. And as I said before, the Conference on Disarmament is meeting this morning in Tempus. It's a plenary meeting under the presidency of Mongolia. We have sent you about disarmament. We have sent you a statement of the Secretary General yesterday on the issue of the START treaty, the inspiration of the new START treaty. And that is all I had for you. I think I haven't forgotten anything. So if there is no further question for me, let me see on the platform. Paola.
Yes, good morning. I understand that Tariq is on the line. I have a question for him regarding the discussions this afternoon, or expected this afternoon, at the WHO Executive Board. Just wondering if, regarding the issue of membership, the discussion about membership, there's the reports that had been presented by Dr. Tedros on membership regarding the U.S. and Argentinian withdrawals. Just wondering if a resolution can be expected or is expected, and otherwise if the board will simply be approving the report.
Yeah, Tariq is with us. I can see him. So, Tariq, I'll give you the floor to answer Paola.
Thank you, Paola. Look, as we speak, the executive board is starting discussion on the item 29, and that's a collaboration within the United Nations system and with other intergovernmental organizations where these issues will be discussed. So, I really can't say what the EB will decide. It's streamed, it's web streamed, so if you want, you can immediately now go on a WHO website and listen to discussions.
Thank you, Tariq. Any other question to WHO? I don't see hands up. So I think that concludes our briefing of today. I thank you very much for following it. Wish you a very good weekend, an Olympic weekend, and we'll see each other on next Tuesday. Thank you.